far as quantum anybody physics are concerned, what we want to understand there is emergent phenomena, quantum mechanicality and topological order, in relation or from the perspective of what we know in quantum information. And finally, all these studies, theoretical studies, happen to be the key to the development of new simulation algorithms for quantum many body systems. And that's also one thing we do. We try to come up with new ideas to classically simulate strongly correlated systems in one or two dimensional lattices. So as I said, that's work that we perform in a team. The group is growing, and also in collaboration with a number of people in Europe, America, and also China. And well, the outline of the talk today is as follows. What I want to do is I will start with a very mild, simple introduction to renormalization group, because well, the renormalization group is going to play an important role in all the talk. Then I will move to talk about ground state entanglement, but if you were here 2 hours ago, Matt Hastings told us quite a lot about ground state entanglement, so I'll just go through some of the results mentioned there. And then the subject of this talk, what I'm trying to do here is to tell you that if we try to have define a renormalization group transformation for quantum systems and lattice, and we try to make it compatible with the amount of entanglement that we typically have in the ground state of the lattice, we realize that we run into problems. But there is no way of defining this transformation such that in practice is efficient. So if you want to regard this transformation, this normalization group transformation, as the basis of a numerical method to simulate the system, it turns out that when you look at the amount of entanglement in the system, you quickly conclude that this is not going to be efficient at all. But there is a way out, at least one. So entanglement renormalization is an idea that tries to fix this problem. It's an idea that tries to put together what we know about ground state entanglement, to try to make compatible the growth of entanglement in lattice systems with having an efficient renormalization group transformation. And what I will do is I'll explain what the entanglement renormalization is about. And in particular, I want to show how it performs in a system at a quantum critical point, and also in a system with topological order. OK, so that's going to be the outline. And I will start with renormalization group transformations. What I've done here, I wasn't sure about what kind of audience I would have. Now I see it's human beings. But I'm not too sure about your background. So what I did is I will start with a very simple introduction, and then we'll step up. So what I have in mind, let me tell you a couple of things about the renormalization group. What I have in mind here is we have an extended system. It could be a spin lattice, a field theory. I'll focus on a lattice system. So what I want you to think about is a system on a lattice that could be an infinite lattice. On each side of the lattice, we have say a two-level vector space starting the possible two-dimensional vector space studying the possible states of the system. And that could correspond, well, as always, maybe a spin 1/2 particle, qubits, Hopping fermions, a number of possibilities. The important thing is we have some finite dimension on each state. Now, the renormalization group is concerned with how the physics of our system change with as we change the scale of observation. And excuse me. And later on, we'll see that this can be used. This kind of ideas can be used to try to devise simulation algorithms. But for the time being, let's look only at it from a theoretical perspective. So a very important idea in the renormalization group is the idea of RG, renormalization group transformation. And this is transformation of your system that can be understood as having two parts. The first one is coarse-graining. Let me go through that. So we have our lattice. Let's call it L0. And there is some Hamiltonian defined on the lattice. Let's assume it's a short-range Hamiltonian between, say, nearest neighbor. Now, the first step will be this coarse-graining. What we want to do is we want to take two of the sides and replace it with just one. by some mechanism, and the hope is that this site still contains degrees of freedom relevant to, say, the low energy properties of the system. So let's not specify for the time being this transformation. Let's just say that it maps two sites into one. And then we can do this everywhere. So we take blocks of two sites, and we replace each block with a single site. The next step would be rescaling. We just take these sites, just put them together, lose it, and we complete. And we may have to add extra number of extra new sites so that we end up with a lattice L1 that, in as far as the degrees of freedom, looks exactly the same as the original lattice. So we have a lattice, again, of two-level systems. But it's not exactly the same system because whatever transformation we applied here, now we can apply to the Victorian. This gives rise to a new Hamiltonian expansion that will effectively describe H0. Okay, so that would be our RC transformation to parse per weakest grain, take two sides into one, and then we rescale the system. Now we can do this a number of times. So we could, again, block these effective sites into a new effective site and rescale. And excuse me. As a result, we could end up with the second lattice and so on. We can apply this a number of times. Now, if we do it, what we obtain is a series of lattices, L0, L1, L2. All these lattices, in principle, may have the same number of degrees of freedom. They are lattices, say, of spin-one-half particles. And what changes here is the Hamiltonian. Notice that, obviously, say, this site here corresponds to effectively the size four sites down here. So as we go up here, one site, a level tau, will describe exponentially many exponentially two to the tau sites down there. So in some sense, what we are doing is we're exploring long distance physics, or similarly, we're going to low energies. Okay, so that is all standard, and probably you probably all already knew all this, and you also knew that the game now could be, well, let's study these Hamiltonians, how the Hamiltonian changes as we look at the system from farther and farther away, or longer and longer distances. We can do that, and then we could plot this Hamiltonian. We could extend it in some space of couplings. It would respond to some point, this one here. And now what we can do is we apply the renormalization group transformation. We obtain the next Hamiltonian. So that's going to be another point. And we do this a number of times. And we obtain the flow of the RG. So, let me just mention from this book, it's of interest. sorry. One of the things that we may want to know is where are the fixed structure of fixed which corresponds to well-defined phases. So if we want to understand the phases of our system, we just have to look for fixed points. And also, we will have and a stable fixed points responding to fixed conditions. So we have this structure of fixed conditions. And an obvious observation that is almost an addition. The fixed point here is that when we have that in the stage of coupling, we identify a fixed point. This the system is scaled under changes of scale measure. Right? So if we have that this is the fixed point, and we start with a Hamiltonian that corresponds to down here, we started with a Hamiltonian that corresponds to this point. Then, as we change my scale, we keep recovering the same. All right, so that was a summary of the normalization group. Now, let's suppose that we want to turn this into a systematic approach to many body systems where we are provided with some. We have a lattice system in one dimension, two dimensions. We are given a Hamiltonian, and we ask, we would like to answer questions such as what are the low, what are the ground state properties of the system? If we want to do that, it is not enough to at this qualitative level, we need to explain exactly what we mean, for instance, by transforming two sides into one. So I want to start discussing this. Okay, so again, we have two sides. That could be two qubits. These two sides correspond to lattice L0. So lattice L0 actually has many, many of these sides, just focusing on two of them. And we want to replace these two sides in just one side for the next lattice. And well, the first step towards doing that is obvious, is we have a four-dimensional vector space here. So let's just consider all four levels that come out of taking the tensor product of the vector spaces on the two sides. And we have a basis there, say 0, 1, 0, 1. Therefore, we have a basis for whole vector space 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. And now, what do we mean by replacing this with this? Well, what we mean in practice is we want to identify some subspace in this vector space that retains the physics that we are interested in studying. Okay, so the idea is we want to find which subspace within this four-dimensional vector space will define the new effective site. An example of this could be, excuse me, could be we could define a new zero as, say, 0, 1, and a new state 1 for the effective site as 1, 0, right? So my hope is that so far everything is very simple. Is there any question? At the moment, let's consider a procedure that does not depend on the range of interactions. Let's just try to constrain our system by according to what it takes two sides into one. Now, okay, so that doesn't really depend on the interactions in the system. I'm not saying that it is possible, this approach is possible, just defining a possible strategy.
Any new basis as you want.
Well, that's the thing. That's precisely the point, right? That turns out that obviously it's not. You cannot randomly choose some basis there. You have to identify the correct subspace for that, and that should be the subspace that contains the physics. So, in particular, well, such approaches have been tried for many years, and in particular, Wilson is who in 1974 explained or proposed a specific, he made the observation that perhaps what we want to do in order to identify the subspace, in order to choose specific subspace, he proposed to look at the energy associated to each subspace. Right? So we have Hamiltonian in our system, and now we could look at the restriction of the Hamiltonian on these two sides. And in this way, we could analyze that Hamiltonian, find some energy levels, and maybe keep the two lowest energy levels there. That's a specific proposal. Now, what happens is this worked well for the problem Wilson was trying to analyze, the problem. But we had to wait until 1992 with Stephen White to really identify a procedure that would work for any system. So looking at the energy levels was only a good idea for a specific problem and didn't work for any other problem. Whereas Stephen White, proposed as part of his method, density metric normalization group, DMRG, to which today Matt Hastings was referring to. So as part of this method, he understood what is the subspace that we want to keep. And the answer, the answer is quite simple, and I'll go through it in a minute. But I just wanted to mention that thanks to identifying this subspace, he managed to develop this technique, the DMRG, which has been the best tool that we have to compute a ground state in one-dimensional systems for the last 15 years. So finding this subspace was quite important there. So what's with the subspace? Well, the answer will be rather obvious now, because we already know it. But let me go through it. So again, let's take the whole lattice, L0, where there is some Hamiltonian H0. Now we're going to take a very strong assumption, which is that we know how to compute the ground state. And be patient with that. I know that it's strange that I assume that when maybe the goal of the whole approach is to find the ground state. But still, let's assume that and see whether we can learn something. So we'll assume that we can compute the ground state for the whole lattice. And now what White says is, well, once you have the ground state for the whole lattice, look at the reduced density metrics for two sides, for the two sides that you want to put together. Okay? And take this reduced density metrics and diagonalize it. So look at, diagonalize it, and then what we will do is we'll take as relevant such space. If we diagonalize it, we have the eigenvalues of this reduced density metrics for the two sides. These eigenvalues are positive, of course, they are a probability distribution. And suppose that two of them are close to zero. What we will do is we'll project on the such space defined, we'll keep up here, we'll keep the such space defined by the two eigenvectors of rho with largest eigenvalues. What we are doing here is we're keeping the support of rho. We're trying to keep in these two dimensions that we have, we're trying to keep as much support of rho as possible. So that's the answer. If you want to do, if you want to keep the properties of the system when you constrain, you have to choose this. Of course, we are assuming that two of these probabilities are going to be very small, and later on we'll see that that's not going to happen in general. But let's assume that this is the case, that we find that two of the probabilities are very small. Then this is the right choice in the following sense. Let's suppose that we have the original lattice. On the original lattice, we have the ground state, and that we want to compute an expectation value for some local observable all. Then, if we make the choice of such space in order to define the constraining, it turns out that you can show that if the ground state on the effective lattice, if this is the ground state on the effective lattice L1, and this is the constrained version of this operator, what will happen is that the observables, whether you compute observables, expectation value of this observable on the original lattice, or you do it on the effective lattice, it's going to give you the same answer. Okay, so in this sense, we're preserving the physics of the original system. We obtain a new system, a new lattice L1, that might not, well, with a new Hamiltonian, so the system has changed. It's only a constrained description. But when we look at the observables, we can compute the observables that we're interested on the original lattice, we can compute them on the constrained lattice. Okay? So summary of all this is we know how to do these things. We know how to, if we could compute the ground state, obviously, but let's assume that. We know that we know how to perform this transformation. Is that clear? Okay. I see one person saying yes. That's good. So now the first observation I want to make is that this procedure, this constraining transformation, will depend on properties of the ground state. It's not a big surprise, but I want to point it out. Right? So again, if we want to constrain, if we want to take all these sides into just one side, what we need to do, or if we want to know how many levels, what sat space, how large the sat space has to be in order to effectively describe all these sides, what we need to do is, once we have the ground state, we can compute the reduced density metrics for this big plot. And look at effectively how many, what's its rank, how many levels rho is supported on. And that will define the dimension of the effective site for the whole block. Okay? That will be the conclusion. And I don't want to say much more about this. I want to leave it there and move to talking about ground state entanglement, because it will happen to be related precisely to this quantity that will characterize the efficiency of the whole approach. So, and as I said, luckily enough, Matt Hastings has been telling us already what I wanted to mention. So, what we can do now is first look at the amount of entanglement that we have in the ground state of the system, the amount of entanglement between the two sides that we want to put together into an effective site, and the rest of the system. So let's write the ground state for the whole lattice. Let's write it in what we call the Schmidt decomposition, which is just an expansion of the state in terms of a basis of states in the block and a basis of the state outside the block. Okay? And now we look at how many terms we have in this decomposition. And also we could look at the reduced density matrix for this block. And what we see is that the rank, the number of relevant the number of relevant probabilities here is exactly the number of Smith coefficients that we have. So the conclusion of this observation is simply that that the more entanglement we have in the system, the larger this sky is going to be, and the more levels we will have to keep on the effective side. There is a relationship between how hard it's going to be to simulate such system to how hard it's going to be to implement this renormalization group formation, and how much entanglement we have in the system. But let's try to quantify this a little bit. So first thing I want to do is to talk about to introduce this entanglement entropy. It's simply the entropy of this reduced density matrix. And this entropy, again, Matt Hest is referring to this entropy. This entropy is going to help us estimate how many levels we want to keep on that effective side. So roughly, what we're going to do is we're going to think that if we have an amount of entropy S for this block, then roughly we're going to keep a number of levels for the block, which is roughly exponential of S. Okay? That's an indication. It's not as strict, but it's going to be good enough for this. So what we would like to know now is we would like to borrow results from other researchers that have been investigating how entanglement scales in ground states, and use them to learn about what effective size, what effective dimension we'll have to consider for blocks for these effective sizes. So it's very simple. What we want to do is we take the lattice for which we already have the ground state. We could go and compute the reduced density matrix for, say, two sites, look at the entropy, and this entropy through this expression is going to tell us roughly how many levels we keep in an effective site that we can place this. Now we can take a block of four sites, do the same, look at the reduced density matrix, look at the entropy, and we'll have an estimate of how many levels we need to keep there, and so on. And these quantities here are well understood, so we can just go and jump to the conclusion and see how many levels we need to keep. So that has to do with the scaling of entanglement in ground states. And for instance, if we have a one-dimensional lattice, and we consider blocks of, say, 2, 4, 8 sites and so on, so L sites, what we know is that this entropy will scale as the logarithm of L, right? We have L sites in the block, and the entropy is going to be log L for a one-dimensional physical system, which implies that effectively, if we want to replace this L site with just one single site, we will need to this effective site will have to have high number of levels, which is polynomial in L. It means that the larger the block, the more levels we need to keep inside. Some power of. Now, what happens in two dimensions? Well, again, we can suppose that we can compute the ground state, and now we consider blocks of, say, 2 times 2, 4 times 4 sites, 8 times 8, and so on. So a block of L times L sites, what we know is that the entropy of this block, a block of L squared sites, goes proportional to the boundary of the block. Right? So what that implies is that the number of effective levels, the number of levels that we have to keep in an effective site for the whole block will grow as the exponential of the size of the boundary of the block. And more generally, there is this boundary law that says that in a d-dimensional lattice, what we have, what we would expect is that the entropy grows as, again, the boundary of the block. Okay, so what does this mean in terms of what we're interested in here? Remember, what we want to do is we want to take two sides together, replace it with some effective side, then we want to put two of these effective sides together. So effectively, four sides of the region. Four original sites together, then 8 original sites together, and so on. And So let's do that, and let's look at how many levels we need to teach iteration. So what we find is that the number of levels that we need to keep in one dimension to account for, to effectively represent a block after tau iterations of this doubling procedure is exponentially tau. The dimension of the effective side will grow exponentially in the number of iterations of our function element. And in two dimensions, it will grow doubly exponential. Okay? We are thinking here that maybe we can apply these ideas and start with a lattice, coarse grain it, and keep coarse graining it. And remember that I started thinking that naively, that maybe I start with two levels and I replace these two sides with a side that also has two levels and so on. What we see is that if we try to follow the procedure that Stephen White proposed, which is the one that will present the physics of the system, what we find is that at each iteration, actually the number of levels on the effective side grows. And it's not that it grows a little bit, it grows a lot. In one dimension, every time we go, we do that. So the number of of levels that we need to preserve grows exponentially in the number of iterations. In two dimensions, it grows doubly exponentially. Okay? So, okay, well, so what? We have a procedure that, in principle, is going to work for us. It's going to give us a correct results, right? If we follow these instructions, what we find, as I said before, is that the effective side will retain the physics of the little, sorry, the effective lattice will retain the physics of the original lattice. But what I just said, this growth of entanglement has two consequences at two levels. One is at the conceptual level. What we have is that when we go from here to here, our lattice has changed. The degrees of freedom in our lattice has changed, right? Originally, I was hoping that we start with spin 1/2 particles and we obtain some other lattice with still spin 1/2 particles and so on. Now what we see is that as we change, as we constrain the system, we obtain more and more dimensions in the effective side. So imagine that you start with spin 1/2 and then after a while you have spin 3, spin 7, spin, right? So the basic degrees of freedom in your theory are changing. That's not good. Well, that's not good. That's a fact. But what it implies is that we have a problem. We cannot compare the system, or at least we don't have the nice feature that we expected, which is that we would compare two Hamiltonians of the same kind of spin, say spin 1/2 particles. Or we were hoping to have spin 1/2, a lattice of spin 1/2 particles here and also here, and just focus on how the Hamiltonian changes. Right? We don't have that anymore. It is not obvious how to define a renormalization group flow, for instance, in the space of Hamiltonians, because the Hamiltonian at each iteration refers to different kinds of degrees of freedom. And in particular, also, we've lost fixed points. It turns out that our system might be critical. We have that system is at a critical, quantum critical point. We have a ground state that we know that it's scaling invariant it's invariant under changes of scale, and yet when we apply this procedure, we find that our system keeps growing. The representation we have of our system is such that the dimension keeps growing. Right? So we've lost.
It grows less than the actual freedom of the block that you're trying to construct,
yes.
Right?
Yes, the block should grow doubly exponentially.
Doubly exponentially, well,
yeah. And it only grows exponentially.
Yeah, while in more than one, it grows more less than the actual block.
It grows a little bit less. The dimensions, it grows a little bit less than the maximum possible.
It's double.
Yes. We've lost all these ideas coming from the renormalization group. We would expect fixed points and a flow, well-defined flow, and we've lost all that. But also, it's not only at the conceptual level that it is not satisfactory, that is not satisfactory. In practice, it implies severe computational limitations. It means that these streams, for instance, so far only work in one-dimensional systems. Typically in non-critical systems, you can push it a little bit to critical systems, but definitely they have no change in dimension. So this real estate renormalization group approaches tend to fail completely in two dimensions. DMRG has been very, very successful in one dimension, but not. So, let's see.
You should even trade out the heavy degrees of freedom.
The heavy degrees of freedom. Yes, we should do that. Exactly, we should do that. But where are they?
Well, in this picture, they would be the high energy states.
Yes. Well, we need to learn already. Yeah, the energy is not a good idea. Because when we look at the energy, the restriction of the Hamiltonian on the block is missing all the correlation with the rest of the system. So I completely agree with you. And what I will do next is address the stabilization without actually having to move into the energy that is affected like that. So we will be able to produce.
The formal level is different here. When you make a block, you use effectively quotient. Take into account. You identify any one of four different species combinations with the single skin. So that's running away in a sense.
In that case,
here you
learn for speech, somehow you're taking information.
But I mean, you're coming overall.
You're taking all of them into account.
Suggest that, like, construction.
Right,
so. Subspace can.
I don't know, I haven't. It is not clear how it's coming out with a dynamic state. So we know that the original state that we're interested in is the ground state, which is pure. And then if we make an local average, if you are thinking of that, I would say when you make an average, holistic average, you will end up with this, which is not likely to be the institution. But if you are thinking of some more mathematical system. Okay, so what is this? I think it's just one. It's from and the others. And in order to I don't even know if I can do this. These were two sides. Let's have an alpha basis here, and beta basis here, and gamma the new basis. And obviously, what we are doing here is identifying such space, which we can expand in terms of alpha and beta, and let omega be the change of basis coefficients. What I want to do is, from now on, I want to, instead of writing some tensors with many indices, I just want to draw things. So instead of writing omega with these three indices, I will draw some some circle, and I will have a number of legs coming out, and each leg will correspond to one of these indices. So how does this transformation look? Our transformation from the original lattice to the effective lattice in terms of these tensors, just this change of basis, right? This side here is expressed, or the basis in this side here is expressed in terms of the tensor of this basis, and the same thing everywhere. Right? So I'm just writing again what I've described before. I'm drawing it this way. And now we put course grain again. So if I want to take these two sides together, I will find the basis here in terms of so called these two bases, and this is the change of basis again. All right, so this is how we've been doing things. It didn't work. We had this problem of growth of the local dimension. And here's a proposal how to do things in a different way that might work. What we've added is a row of tensors, of vector tensors, in the change of basis from the original side, the original lattice to the effective one, that I will call these entanglers. And the goal is still the same. The goal is to take, say, these two sides. We want to take these two sides. We want to replace them with. Okay? But now, instead of just going directly and expressing the local basis in terms of the basis here, we will make a transformation. As written by this tensor. This tensor is going to be a unitary transformation. It will transform one of the spins in the block with a neighboring spin outside the block. And the same thing. right? So before we take these two sites together, we let these two, these sites evolve with sites outside the block, and then we take them. So we are adding extra freedom in the process. And why do we call this disentangles, or what's the point of doing that? I think the best way to illustrate this is directly with an example, and it will be the following one. Suppose that the state, the ground state of our system, is just a collection of singlet or maximal entangled states between nearest neighbors. And according to this, so these two sides are in a maximal entangled state, these two sides are in a maximal entangled state, and so on. Now, if I want to constrain the system directly, what will happen is that, well, this side is entangled with this one, and this side is entangled with this one. So when I put these two together, they still are entangled with the neighbors. Okay? I'm preserving the properties of the system. If there was entangled, they should still be entangled. Let's look at how this looks down here instead. Again, we have the same initial state. It's a collection of just nearest neighbor singlets. But now what we're going to do is we're going to use this disentangler, this unitary transformation that we allow between nearest sites, to transform this singlet into a product state. Okay, you have two sides, a maximal entangled state, but now you let them evolve together into a product state. So we'll choose in this particular, if we were given this ground state, we would choose these disentanglers, sites that they do this, they disentangle singlets. After we do that, what we end up with is with a collection of sites which are disentangled. Now we can put them together. And effectively, what we have obtained is that the new effective lattice besides the original state has been transformed into a product state. So without these entanglers, we end up with a highly entangled state. That. With these entanglers, we end up with a product state. That's only an example. I will never in practice, I don't expect to have such a simple ground state in my system. But it illustrates what the power of this disentanglers is. It allows you to remove entanglement from the system before you first train. And so in particular, as far as this counting the levels of the effective site is concerned, what we see is in here, right, the effective site has to have four levels. It just it has to account for correlations two singlets, one left side, one right side. So four levels that we need to keep. Because down here, thanks to using these entanglers and removing these singlets, what we have is finally a product state. So this effective site actually only needs to keep one level. Effectively, there is only one dimension of the space that is relevant for the problem. Okay, so that's this conceptually should be clear that we add this row of extra pieces of unitary transformations or these entanglers, and that the goal or what they are good for is to remove entanglement in the system, and consequently can reduce the number of levels we need to. Okay, so that was the main idea, and now what I would like to explain is how this works in practice. So remember, our goal is we start with some lattice L0, and we want to produce some effective lattice L1, and so on. In this diagrammatic representation, that's the traditional approach, if you want. And with these entanglers, we replace this diagram with this one. Again, we have L0 here, which is transforming L1, and increasingly cross-grained lattices, and we go from one lattice to the next one by first applying a row of disentanglers and then putting together two sides into one. So what happens when we do that? What we see is the following. We see that at this level of the renormalization group transformation, instead of having sides that whose dimension keeps growing, suddenly a constant dimension is enough to capture to keep the local support of the reduced density matrix. So in one dimension, for instance, if we plot the logarithm of the dimension that we had as a function of iterations, what we had without these entanglers is this tau, which was exponential, and chi of tau was exponential in tau. Now, with this entangler, suddenly it's flat. We actually are able to start with spin one half part and keep adding spin one half part. And same thing in two dimensions. We start with a double exponential growth, but as soon as we apply the disentanglers, if we choose them properly, what we find is that, again, we have a constant local dimension. So that's very interesting numerically, because it allows you to devise algorithms that can address systems. It is always, this is a numerical procedure, so it's approximately. If you keep it constant, you will be making this error. So the important thing is that this error is small, and it increases exponentially the size of the normal relative. So if you're not happy with the degree of approximation that you obtain by only two levels, you put three levels, and this would reduce the error exponentially. So the error would decrease exponentially in the number of levels you decide.
You think
the same number of levels at least.
But it grows.
No.
Error?
Oh, the error for local observables does not grow with the size of the system. The error for local observables, the energy or what for it, will not grow with the size of the system. If you're interested, I can give you more details. Okay. So that would be numerically interesting. Yes.
Keep track of that.
Yes, but that's not cost.
Okay.
You look at this scheme, at this diagram, maybe it's not completely clear, but what you see is that at this level, the number of these entanglers is divided. So, altogether, if this is a system of size n, it's still number of in there. It's been in the structure system. You have to do a number of things, and I won't get into those details, right? But basically, you have to find algorithms to find these disentanglers. But I don't want to explain the details of the algorithms. The algorithms are there and then to use this piece of them.
I guess that's the same question. If you don't know ground state, how do you choose a state in bank?
It might be difficult or easy. There are algorithms in this one. But I prefer not to focus on that. I have not explained how to find the ground state, how to find this.
Because it could still happen that you've got state, but with
partial
states.
But what?
It could still happen that you disentangle.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Keeping a constant dimension is at most. Sometimes you could keep less of constant. So the dimension could be fixed. What I'm saying is it doesn't have to be fixed.
It doesn't.
Yes. Okay, so. So, that's interesting numerically. You know, you have some algorithm to address these problems, but now also, certainly, it's nice. So, you recall all these ideas. You have a lattice at some level of constraint, which is identical in terms of number of pieces of the next one, and therefore it makes sense to compare the Hamiltonian. And suddenly, you recover these ideas of renormalization group flow and so on. So, all these theoretical ideas that work so well, say, in momentum space. You recover them. Okay, so what happens when we address, let's have 15 minutes left, so I think I have time for this. I would like to explain to you what happens when we apply this to a system with a critical point, and maybe I'll show you this. So first, if we have a system, a symmetry break ordered system with a gap, so not at the critical point. What we would find is the following. We start with, and we have some algorithm to find these disentanglers. What we see is that the ground state down here, okay, that would be the ground state of the system we're interested in, is transformed effectively, or the next lattice is effectively transformed into some other ground state. And we have a sequence of ground states corresponding to increasingly coordinate lattices. What we find is that after some iteration, the ground state is a product state. All the entanglement is gone. Okay? So this ground state here might be very entangled. After a finite number of iterations, we find that the ground state is entangled. And in particular, and that should not be a surprise, well, first, once we have this product state, if we iterate further, we just keep recovering the same product state. So this is a fixed point of this approach, right? Once we have removed the entanglement of the system, we obtain a fixed point corresponding to a well-defined phase of the system. Now, not surprisingly, this happens. We obtain this entangled ground state as soon as the affected sites here describe number of sites, the original lattice, that are slightly larger than the collision rate. Right? So once the affected sites respond to sizes of the system that are beyond the correlation length in the system, we systematically find that the ground state is a product state. No surprises there. Now, having said that, let's see what happens for a critical system. Well, you know that the correlation length there is infinite, so we should never expect to find a product state. What we find instead, and that's, I would say, quite nice, is that we start with some ground state. By this procedure, we find another ground state, and out of a sudden, we realize that, oh, wait, that ground state is the same as we said before. From then on, it remains. So in this case, these ground states are highly entangled. Right? They are not product state, but again, they are a fixed point of this procedure. And so, well, that corresponds to. That's a way of characterizing, from the perspective of entanglement, it's a way of characterizing whether we have we are at a critical point or not. We apply this algorithm and we see whether we get a fixed point which is disentangled or a fixed point which is highly entangled.
We typically have an it's finite, there will never be a
okay, so what we then see is this, yes, we have a characterization in terms of critical stable fixed points of RG and stable fixed points of RG. So a stable fixed points correspond or end up being represented by a product state and a stable fixed points correspond to critical system. Yes, so I'm running short of time. Let me mention a couple of things about topological order now, what happens when we apply this approach to system with topological order. And in this case, what we consider our system two dimensions, that is a proper generalization. The structure I've been showing to you, these diagrams were for one-dimensional systems. This can be generalized into two dimensions in many ways. And now what I have in mind is a system, a lattice. Our lattice is on a torus. And as you know, when we have a system, a model with topological order, in particular, what we have is the ground state in a torus will be degenerate, typically. And what we're going to do now is, well, I would like to be able to see how this construction, this diagram that we'll call Mira, the scale entanglement renormalization ansatz, how this Mira looks like in this case. So we're going to apply this renormalization transformation to this system when the system is in one of these ground states. And remember, an important property of these ground states is that these two ground states, of course, well, they are orthogonal, but whenever we look at the reduced density metrics of one of these ground states on a region of the lattice that can be contracted to a point, what happens is that the reduced density metrics coming from one of the ground states or from the other, they are identical. We cannot distinguish. If we look, these two states might be this. But when we look at the reduced density metrics from a region that can be contracted to a point, then the reduced density metrics are the same. We cannot distinguish these ground states properly. Okay? So what this will mean, and on the other hand, if the region was not, if the region cannot be contracted to a point, what we will find is that suddenly we might be able to distinguish the two ground states by just looking at the reduced density metrics on this region. So what this means in terms of disentanglers is the following. These disentanglers and these isometries, all these tensors that I was building, depend on a lot of properties. You only need to know the resistance density matrix on a region. If the region is contractible to a point, for when I try to determine disentanglers, isometries for this guy, or for that guy, they are going to be sacrificed. So as long as I look at regions that are sufficiently small, what I find is that I'm building the same mirror for both. Except when I get to the top, when I get to the top of this construction, suddenly I have a small torus, a torus with not many sides. And then the Coarse-Grained version of these two states, remember, they are orthogonal. And then I will see that these two states are orthogonal, and I will end up with a tensor on the top of the mirror, which is different from this for these two states. What this means is that if I try to use this tensor network, this mirror, to represent ground states in topological order, what we find is that this is actually a very natural representation of such states, because all the tensors are going to be identical, except for the top one. Only on the top tensor of this representation, we will include stored topological information in the system. All the topological degrees of freedom of the system are stored at the top of this representation. The rest, that's unknown about topological of it. And so, well, we've done this. We found this originally. This was a collaboration with Miguel Aguado and the Max Planck Institute in Munich. We analyzed this originally for the toric code. Then we realized that it extends. But this argument is general. So this argument is independent of the model. As if you have two ground states which are in a system with topological order, ground states cannot be distinguished locally, then you'll have the topology, that all the information, the topological information will be stored in the bubble. Okay, so I think I just wanted to mention some developments. Some other people are working on this as well. Maybe the good news is that for a while this was just some idea, and now it's turned into algorithms, and we are able to simulate two-dimensional systems. We say 500 spins, and well, this is work in progress. So everything I say has to be taken into caution, but it looks very, very promising in the sense that we can say in a two-dimensional spin system, we can identify phase transitions and compute ground state energies without any, this seems to be working. So I wish I could plot, I have some plots. If you want to see them later, ask me. But I just don't know how reliable these results are yet. So, but we will have these approaches. And the latest news, and this is from last week in Vienna, is that together with Frank Verstappen, we have understood how to simulate also interacting terminals with this scheme. And you probably know that interacting terminals is a problem. Well, these are problems where quantum Monte Carlo techniques would not work. So we look forward to seeing how this ends up. All right, so it's time for me to summarize what I wanted to tell you. I started with an introduction to the normalization group, mentioning that it studies how the properties of an extended system change as we change the scale of observation. And then I focused on explaining that due to the scaling of entanglement in the system, the ground state of extended systems, we had the usual approaches would fail, in the sense that we would not obtain a renormalization group, a well-defined renormalization group flow, because the local dimension of the size kept growing meaningfully compared to systems. We have a scale about the system that our future that wasn't very satisfying. And also, in practice, we could only analyze small systems into dimensions. And then a possible way out of this, it's maybe there are other possibilities, is to use this idea of trying to disentangle the system locally before making the coarse grain using these disentanglers. And this approach seems to work quite well. In particular, we recovered the notion of renormalization group flow, use it there. We see that scale invariance is shows explicitly in the scheme because you get the same state, the same system at each iteration of the RG transformation. And as a consequence, we can analyze with arbitrary sizes. And as an example, with this laptop, within 2 minutes, a one-dimensional system with a million, I could find the ground state with five, I can find the ground state energy with 5 digits of precision for a system of 1,000 states, a million states, I mean, within minutes. So, yeah, and the conclusion of all this, perhaps, is that we have identified also a new way of representing ground states. So we started trying to define a renormalization group transformation, but the net product of this renormalization group transformation is a set of disentanglers and isometries, all these tensors. Now we can use to actually obtain a representation of the ground state. Okay, and this ground state representation seems to be good for critical systems where it becomes, the representation itself becomes scale invariant, have the same disentanglers and isometries at each level. And also it's good to represent systems with topological order. Thank you.
Multi-scale entanglement renormalization transfer.
The algorithms that you mentioned for disentanglers, are those purely numerical or could they be used to gain, say, analytical insight into the ground state and maybe improve analytical properties and so
forth? Well, I'm hoping that it will be useful analytically as well. We are finding promising results when we try to use this approach to by the suppressing the filtering and then going to the and we see the collisions. There is some structure that goes beyond. Oh, numerically we observe this on the other hand, all the system topological order results are analytical, they are non-numerical. So find that this construction. Yeah, this construction for any model critical quantum bubble.
You say you would explain, but how do you do when you don't know what ground state and you want to find it?
Okay, so now we have this structure, maybe it should go. So let's suppose an example that we have a gap system. We have a gap system. And now what you see here is the after we have a product state. It's efficiently represented. It's not, the complexity of representing a product state has happened. Give me the state inside. And then we have all these sets of transformations. So far, we were looking at this as a way of explaining. Now, these are all the transformations. And now, this is the summary. So, right, what I'm saying here is. Have the ground state function starting from a product state and applying a number of gates to it. Okay? Start with the product state. Now you apply some gates. And you obtain a ground state. Now I'm gonna do this. So now what we find is that this circuit is very special. It has the property that the causal form of any side of here. If you take the causal, if you look at all the gates involved in determining the distance of the metric scale, what you realize is that it's a number that does not grow. So at most, maybe we can discuss this later, but it has very special properties. This graph has very special properties such that it can be contracted efficiently. So if you want to know how much the norm of this state is, you can do it very simply. In a very simple way. As a result of this, what you can do in the end is to determine all these gates through some variational method. What you do is you don't assume any specific form for these gates. You just consider a product state on the top
an arbitrary gauge here. And now you try to minimize the energy associated. This defines some step. And now you take what you do. So this mirror with not with all the gates have not yet been, that gives you some step. Now what you do is you look minimum over all these gates. So here, what you will do is look for the gates that you need energy. And the good news is that computing this quantity, even if you are dealing with a system of size, because computing this ends up being n log n, or if you have this invariance, of course, ends up being log n. Which is how we can end up at multi. Because the cost of our solution is only logarithmic in the size of the system. I'm not happy with this question. This is
follow expression. I mean, this path energy, obvious method would be double exponential, but this one is not singly exponential.
No. We go from exponential, so the cost should be exponential in n.
Right.
And we go through logarithmic in n. It's
so minimizing over these criteria, which are, you know, there are, if there are tests, I don't know.
No. This emitter is such that they are all, this index has finite dimension. So at each level, these emitters are small. They are chi squared times chi squared matrices.
That's right. There are n squares. There are n of
them. Yes, so that would be where n log n. That's where this backward function is.
And minimization don't vary of all.
Yes, but if your system is invariant, you can only to optimize one at itself. There are log n levels, which is where log n. So there is no magic here. What happens is ground states have. It seems to be the case the ground states are satisfied. If you try to express the generic state of n states with this factor, just that we have somehow identified a spectral correlation, and we have to pose an answer that reflects this correlation.
But I mean, so it means basically you have a class of states, and you hope or you claim that this contains ground states. But I mean, you cannot contain the ground state of any system.
There are no theorems here. I'm not gonna continue. This is an empirical observation, empirical meaning numerical, that every time we try to represent a ground state of interest in condensed matter, then well, we already know one, which is ground states are very special. Look at the scaling of entropy. This is not a random state in fluid space, it's the result of trying to fulfill all these local constraints given by the Hamiltonian. But it turns out that there is a lot of structure as a result of being a ground state. And it seems she's captured that structure in a very efficient way. But again, if you come up with if you show me that the ground state cannot be written in this way, then I won't have that. I'll just use it as another example of ground.
We've tried this
in the spin model. Yeah. But also we have tried how this looks in the case of three-parent of the orders. We are about to try it there. The problem there is there is a new one symmetry in the system that can be exploited to simplify it. So these entanglements can be further simplified because the system has some lot of particle conservation.
and where implemented is on the bottom. So previous attempts to use this scheme to analyze an antiferromagnet, Heisenberg antiferromagnet, gave results of the solution. But it was clear this was just because we were not using sufficiently light. So the problem is simply that for instance in one dimension, this cost times the magnet. So it's this cost times chi, number of levels that we give to the index to the magnet. So that means that we can use chi for 2, 3, 4, 5, but much more. So we can run simulations with now, whenever you have a system with a particle distribution, this is very demanding on the unity. If you don't use the extra structure that this conservation model gives to the units. So in order to analyze, what we saw is that we were not getting very accurate results. The results were improving with this. Right. So for the Ising model, we could get 7 digits down to energy with chi 4 or 5. For the XX1 model, we will put only one of these. So what we stop doing that, so many steps. We are now implementing the symmetries and incorporating the symmetries of the problem to the data. And that we know already because experience to allow us to pay much more.
I think you
can just expand the discussion after the next round.